Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Karen Kiefer, a member of the club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for this evening. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Mal Warwick is the co-author with Paul Pollack of The Business Solution to Poverty, which will be on sale after the program, and Mal has agreed to sign the books. Mal is a prolific author, impact investor, and activist who reviews books on his blog, which is Mal Warwick on Books. He's also one of three partners in the One World Football Project, LLC, a social enterprise and B Corporation based in Berkeley that distributes a unique, virtually indestructible soccer ball to disadvantaged young people around the world. I'm sure I'll tell you more about that. Previously, Mal co-authored with Ben Cohen, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, Values-Driven Business, How to Change the World, Make Money, and Have Fun, and edited the subsequent six volumes in the Social Venture Network, or SVN, book series from Barrett Kohler Publishers. He chaired the board of SVN from 2002 to 2006 and was a co-founder of Business for Social Responsibility in 1992. From 1979 to 2010, Mal focused on the nonprofit sector as a consultant and public speaker on marketing and fundraising for nonprofit organizations, speaking at conferences, workshops, and on university campuses on six continents, probably not Antarctica. He taught fundraising and marketing to nonprofit executives from more than 100 countries. The consulting firm he founded in 1979, now an employee-owned B Corporation named Mal Warwick Donor Digital, maintains offices in Berkeley and Washington, D.C. He continues to serve as board chair there. Mal served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador from 1965 to 1969. Now I'd like to welcome Mal Warwick to the podium.
Thank you very much, Karen, and thank you all for coming. It's great to be with you this evening. I'm going to take this book down so because it's in people's way. So tonight our subject is global poverty, and I'm going to present to you a perspective on it that I think may be a little different from what you are accustomed to hearing about. So without any further blather from me, let's launch into the topic. The reality is that today, out of the 7-plus billion people in the world, some 2.7 billion individuals live on $2 a day or less. That's close to 4 out of every 10 people on the planet. Most significantly, from my perspective, that number, 2.7 billion, is greater than the total population of the planet in 1950 when the fight against global poverty began. Let that sink in. We know, just looking at these bald-faced numbers to begin with, that whatever it is that has been done so far has not worked. Now, we've seen all and heard all the frothy press releases from the United Nations and the World Bank about how much progress they're making in combating poverty. But it doesn't seem to me that fits with the basic fact that I've just revealed, that there are more poor people now than there were people of all classes 60 years ago. We know that corporate social responsibility, CSR, has been at best cosmetic, at worst simple greenwashing. We know impact investors tend to confuse profit and mission. And guess what gets left out when they weigh the two in the balance? Lastly, we know, because we've seen decades, in fact, for that matter, centuries of experience with charity, that you can't donate people out of poverty. It doesn't work. You create dependence, and you reinforce the self-doubt that is one of the primary hindrances against people getting themselves out of poverty in the first place. So how can we make a difference for these 2.7 billion people who are living in such dire circumstances now? First fact to confront is that poor people must invest their own time and money in order to lift themselves out of poverty. There has to be effort, there has to be commitment. It won't work otherwise. And this has been proven again and again and again. Second of all, we know, despite all of the attention being given to urbanization, which is, of course, a major force in world history, the fact is that 70% of those 2.7 billion people live in rural areas, mostly in small villages, a great many of them, majority of them, isolated. So that what we're talking about are people who directly or indirectly depend on farming for their livelihood. Those are two incontrovertible facts that seem to have been ignored in the overwhelming majority of official efforts to end poverty in the world. Now, some 33 years ago, my co-author Paul Polak retired from the practice of psychiatry and decided that he wanted to help make a difference for people, not one by one, but in large numbers. He decided to cure poverty. And after spending a good deal of time traipsing around the byways of places like Somalia and Bangladesh and Zimbabwe, he founded an organization called International Development Enterprises, IDE. That organization was based on the proposition that instead of treating people like objects, like subjects of charity, recipients of largesse from the rich countries of the world, that they needed to be treated like customers, with all due deference that is given to customers by any business. And over the years, in the 80s and into the 90s, IDE began a program, undertook a program to commercialize a device called the treadle pump. This was their earliest big breakthrough project, though there are a great many other projects. The treadle pump is a device like a Stairmaster, which uses leg power to create pressure to bring water up from as deep as, say, 20, 25 feet below the ground. It was a solution that was ideally suited to northern Bangladesh, where the effort began. So the farmers who use this treadle pump dramatically increase their incomes, not just incrementally, not by $100 a year or $200 a year, but often by many hundreds and even thousands of dollars per year. And these are people who at the time were living on a dollar a day. So this had a profound impact on the villages where the device was introduced. And more than the farmers, though, benefited from this effort because devices themselves were manufactured in village shops. There was a network of 75 village manufacturers that IDE contracted with in the course of several years. They contracted also with a group of some 3,000 retail outlets in towns and villages all over northern Bangladesh. They had to hire local people to drill the wells. The whole device installed was sold for about $25. And this course, somebody living on a dollar a day, that's a lot of money. But they also found ways where necessary to finance that, working with local financial institutions. The key, as Dr. Polak discovered and as this project moved forward, was marketing. It was not easy to persuade people to try the treadle pump. It was something new and different. They were not used to change in their lives. They resisted change because they lived on the margin. So they used IDE, Paul and his colleagues used every available means of communication that would get to the people in these villages. They hired bands of roving troubadours. They hired a band of professional actors to go around and put on skits dramatizing the value of the treadle pump. They even made a Bollywood movie, which was seen by a million people in a year. So they made another one and another after that. It became an annual feature of their marketing. It cost them $25,000 to make that first movie, including hiring a star from Bollywood, if you can believe that. So this was the way in which IDE operated, treating poor people as customers. Over the years, IDE invested a total, mostly through donations, though a great deal of it from the revenue of selling the treadle pumps, of about $78 million. This is over the course of 25 years. The farmers themselves invested something under twice as much as that, $140-some million. The upshot, however, the economic impact of that very modest investment was that annually the farmers who had participated in the program increased their net income by $288 million. Annually over the decades. Now, those people moved from poverty into the middle class. There were some 20 million of them, and it was quite a triumph. Unfortunately, though, and Paul took stock of all this after 25 years at IDE, he looked around the world, realized that there are nearly 3 billion people who live on just a pittance every day, he decided that it was just simply a drop in the ocean. And he wanted to find a way to approach the problem of poverty on a much larger scale, to really begin to address the needs of those 2.7 billion people. So that's when the thought process began. Where do the resources exist? The resources and the incentives. Where do they exist that in such a way as the needs can be met and the resources for expansion can be found? And there really is only one answer. It's very obvious. It's the private sector. Something on the order of $150 billion a year is invested globally in development. And that includes all kinds of efforts to build factories in cities and hire middle-class people for good jobs. It certainly does not all go to address the needs of poor people. So that $150 billion is less than 1/6 of the amount of money that is invested by businesses from rich countries in the emerging nations of the world, about $1 trillion every year. The total economy of the planet is on the order now of $75 trillion. So big as these foreign aid and UN and World Bank programs may seem, they really are trivial in comparison with the problem. And in order to address this monumental challenge of nearly 3 billion people living in poverty, we need to find a way to harness the resources of the private sector, hence the business solution to poverty. There are limitless opportunities for business to make a profit, to realize what C.K. Prahalad and Stuart Hart years ago called the fortune at the bottom of the pyramid. That book, you're probably familiar with it, began the debate and provoked a lot of interest among the multinational corporations of the world in finding ways to pioneer their efforts in new markets. The reality is, however, that they went practically nowhere. There's a handful of examples of projects, business projects, that were based on the design in the fortune at the bottom of the pyramid that actually succeeded to any meaningful degree. For the most part, the efforts that were undertaken in response to that call were unsuccessful. So there needs to be some new approach. We need to find a way to deal with this. And yet we look at the opportunities. There are a billion people, more or less, who lack access to electricity in the world. One out of every seven human beings. Again, about a billion people lack access to safe drinking water. And you can just imagine the health problems occasioned by drinking polluted water. A billion farmers, probably more, lack access to irrigation. They're farming largely arid land, and they are limited to one crop per year in almost all cases. And with irrigation, they can triple or quadruple their income and, in the process, lift themselves and their families out of poverty. So how can business take advantage of these opportunities? That was the problem that Dr. Polak confronted back in 2006. The process that he began to devise then and that we've codified and have termed zero-based design is the answer. It's an approach to designing holistically an enterprise that will take advantage of one of these opportunities and that over time will enable a business to realize considerable profits and to address the needs of hundreds of millions of customers and begin to really make a difference in the lives of millions of them. So the first of the eight principal elements in zero-based design is listening. You have to spend hundreds of hours talking to prospective customers before you even think about what you're going to do in response to the problem that you perceive as an outsider. If you're going to set up a business, you go and you sit down and talk for hours on end with people who are your prospective customers, and you learn the context in which they live their lives. You learn what they need, what they believe, what their aspirations are, what their needs are as they perceive them. That's for starters. That's the fundamental step you have to take if you are going to do business in this raw new market of billions of poor people. Secondly, you learn very quickly. If you're dealing with people who live on a dollar or $2 a day, that they really can't afford very much. That if you think what you're going to do is to take some product that is sold widely in the U.S. or Germany and make it more cheaply out of cheaper materials and cut out the bells and whistles and manufacture it locally so that the production process is cheaper, and then cut the price by 20 or 30%, you've lost the game before it started. It's not enough. You really have have to think in terms of nearly an order of magnitude lower price, a game-changing price, 80%, 90% below what would be charged in the global north. From the outset, you need to think in terms of scale. There is no no point in starting a business that will help one village or one town or one province or state in some one country by producing something or delivering some service that will address a local need. That's fine. If that's what you want to do, you're free to do it, obviously, and many people do, but that doesn't address the problem of global poverty. It doesn't get to scale. So you have to begin with a problem like the lack of safe drinking water or the lack of access to electricity that affects a billion people or more. That way, if you are really good and your business really succeeds and you gain a market share of, say, 10%, you can begin to affect the lives of 100 million customers or more and make a material impact on the problem of poverty. Scale has to be designed from in the model from the very beginning. Also, there are those, Muhammad Yunus among them, who seem to have the idea that you can start so-called social businesses that will never make a profit, and that people who invest in them should only expect to get their money back if they're lucky. Well, that's nice. There are some people who are willing to put money into ventures like that, but I can guarantee you that they are few and far between among the investors, even the philanthropists of the world. That you have to design a business that from the outset is fully capable of turning a profit, and not just a modest profit, a profit that is large enough that you can attract outside investors. That's the key, because to build a business that will operate multinationally and will have 100 million customers or more is going to require a lot of capital. Not at the outset, you start small, but over time, you need continual infusions of additional capital, and you will only get that if you can promise investors a hefty return. In the Hindi and Urdu languages, there's a term called jugaad, and there's even a book written about jugaad innovation. We in the United States talk about American ingenuity. Well, this is South Asia's answer to American ingenuity. It means making do with what you've got. It means using what's available locally, making lemonade out of lemons. It's a mindset. It's a learning mindset. It's a willingness to roll with reality as your venture begins to be built. Also, you will discover, if you've done work in rural development, you'll be aware that one of the very biggest impediments to success has been the lack of what is called last mile distribution. This is a term that arose in the telecom industry, where the phone companies had to run wire the last mile to people's homes, not just to the distribution centers, because these were wired, not wireless solutions. So the problem, it becomes triply difficult in rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, parts of Latin America, because villages are isolated, sometimes as much as 5 days' walk from the nearest road. I'll bet some of you in this audience have experienced that and done a little of that kind of walking. I have. So the key is to find a way to build a network or make use of an existing one that will allow you to deliver your product and service directly to the people who are going to buy it. Because you're not going to get them to come to the cities to buy whatever it is you're selling. In order to really achieve market share, really achieve broad impact, you have to get out into people's homes. Then there is the question of aspirational branding. Now, we all know what a brand is. I mean, certainly the advertisers of the world have made us aware of that in recent decades. Aspirational branding is a term that emphasizes the psychic rewards that people receive from purchases that they make. It emphasizes the psychological aspect of consumption. People don't just buy value. They buy satisfaction. And this becomes doubly true of very poor people. They have such limited funds, every dollar has to go 3 times, 5 times, 10 times as far. And it has to be spent on something that will truly deliver value and make everybody involved, the whole family, feel good about the purchase. So aspirational branding is key. You can't just distribute goods in bulk containers with generic markings on them. You have to have brand. Lastly, as I noted before, Dr. Pollack's experience with international development enterprises, marketing really becomes the central challenge, because we're talking about attitude changes, and attitude changes, as you're well aware, don't come easy. So it requires a very creative use of every available communications channel locally. Now, this will include everything, those sorts of things I mentioned earlier, the troubadours, the actors, holding festivals where demonstrations are put on for villagers, a blitz marketing team of 8 or 10 or 12 people who go door to door, trailed by an auto rickshaw blaring music to get everybody's attention. It requires marketing in context requires a full understanding of how people get information, what is likely to influence them. And it's only with that perspective on marketing that it becomes possible for a business to do a very successful job in approaching the $2 a day customers of the world. So with this process, Paul and I believe that it is possible for the companies that we're building and that maybe some of you will be building can reach at least 100 million customers in the course of a decade, can generate more than $10 billion in annual revenue, and can generate generous enough profits that outside investors will be attracted. Tall order, isn't it? Sounds pretty ambitious, right? Well, I'm going to give you very briefly examples of three companies that are now in operation in India, various stages, that are built on this model using this zero-based design method. That Paul and I believe will fit this bill. First of all, one called Sun Water. Paul worked with a group of volunteer space engineers from a company called Ball Aerospace, who worked with him to design a solar generator that will cost 80% less than the diesel pumps that are now used so widely in India. 7 million of them in farming applications according to the numbers that he's reported to me. So you can see the environmental advantages of replacing diesel with solar, but the fact that the device will cost $1,500 rather than $7,500 is going to make a huge difference. And this company is now in the beta stage, in very successful testing in the Indian countryside. Second company is called Transform Energy. As you may be aware, it's possible to convert agricultural waste into briquettes or pellets that have a very high energy content and emit very low amounts of carbon. These briquettes or pellets are used often in electric and coal-fired electric generating plants to lower the carbon output and to gain carbon credits for the owners. So there's a huge, huge market for this in Europe and in China, perhaps a $250 billion market. And Transform Energy has taken on the challenge of designing the oven that is the sort of oven that is currently used to convert agricultural waste into briquettes, currently costing $10 million to $40 million a piece, into a $25,000 unit that will go into an individual village. And used as the basis for a village-based business, which can hire local people to gather the agricultural waste, to run the oven, to do the pickup and delivery, this kind of business can, and we believe will, generate $1,000 a day in additional income for a village. Now, a typical village will have maybe 1,000 people in it. So we're talking about, just broadly speaking, for everybody, an extra dollar a day in income. But that is just the beginning. The third of these companies is called Spring Health. Spring Health Private India Limited. Technically speaking, Spring Health has been in business for a couple of years now in India. It has over 200,000 customers in villages in the state of Odisha, which used to be called Orissa, in eastern India. Company has recently secured significant funding and is on the verge of expanding at the rate of 50 villages per month. We're in 200 villages now. We expect to be in a lot more in just another few years. Spring Health addresses the problem of contaminated drinking water, drinking and cooking water. As you know, not just in India, but in much of the developing world, people get their drinking water and the water that they use to wash and cook with from local streams and wells, and very, very frequently, it's contaminated with fecal pathogens because of the lack of sanitation. So Spring Health addresses this problem affordably. Here's the first part of the solution. It is an off-the-shelf electrochlorinator, a device made by a foundation in Switzerland that costs about $250. And can generate up to 80,000 liters a day in chlorinated and thus safe drinking water. That compares to the reverse osmosis process, which is very widely used in towns and cities in India and elsewhere in the world to provide safe drinking water. Those units cost $6,000. And they may generate 3,000 or 4,000 liters a day. So this is a dramatically more cost-effective solution. And the villagers like the taste, just in case you're wondering. It works. So the second part of the solution, and this is the key because it gets us the network of delivery. delivery network for the last mile solution. A network of mom and pop shops. Go into almost any village in the world and you'll find, what do you find? One or more little shops there selling things that people think of as necessities, like tobacco and cosmetics and soda pop and whatever. Well, Spring Health sends an advanced team into a village, meets with the village elders, solicits from them an introduction to the best, most reliable, the most honest shopkeeper in town. And then they go and contract with that shopkeeper to become a distributor for Spring Health. Once a contract is signed, the company builds a 3,000-liter cement tank using local artisans to do that, branded for Spring Health with its logo and its colors on the side, and the shopkeeper gets 25% of the gross revenue up to the first 1,000 liters a day of sales, and then gets 50% of all revenue after that. So this becomes a very lucrative proposition for the local shopkeeper. What they have discovered in village after village is that people don't want to come to the shop to pick up the water. They want it delivered to their homes. More than 80% of people demand home delivery, and they pay an extra couple cents a day for that. So that it is it's also a way to hire local people who deliver usually by auto rickshaw now. They discovered that that's the most cost-effective way to operate. So that's the second part of the solution. And the third is, as I've just described, the delivery system, because it will go directly to people's homes, and these young people will carry those jerry cans, 10-liter jerry cans, on their backs if they have to, and traipse across the fields just to get to somebody's house. Over the course of the next 10 years or so, Spring Health intends to expand dramatically. We hope that we will have at least 200 million customers by the middle of the next decade. And that could be in India alone, although the company is already looking to expand into several additional countries, and we hope eventually into 20 countries or more. So to accomplish this, it really only takes one person and a dream. Maybe that's you. Want to change the world? I'll bet some of you do want to change the world. So if you want to access a video that gives you more details about zero-based design, you can get it at the address, the following address. And I have to take off my glasses to read that. It's at businesssolutiontopoverty.com/zero-based-design. Now you know. That website contains lots and lots of other additional information. I've been doing a blog. Paul has done a blog from time to time as well for about a year now. So there's an awful lot of free information up there, and I invite you to visit. So that is my presentation. Thank you.
Can you hear me? Okay. Our thanks to Mal Warwick for his very interesting presentation. I'm excited about it. anyway, I'm Karen Kiefer, a member of the club's International Relations Forum. And while we're waiting for you to get your questions together, I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to The Business Solution to Poverty, Designing Products and Services for 3 Billion New Customers with Mal Warwick. So the first question. Does anybody have a first question? Okay, I have one after you.
Find places where there is relative peace for your working, because I'm thinking of all the places where these could be used, but they're too busy killing each other. Mm-hmm. So how do you pick areas where that's not likely to happen?
That is a very good question. I have a somewhat long answer to that. First of all, Northeast India is notoriously violence prone. There are revolutionary movements underway in several states. It's been the center of much of the violence. And Paul picked Odisha state to start with and has picked neighboring states to expand into. In the belief that this will transcend the political divisions in the area. Now, why would he think that? Why would I think that? I worked for a time, I was on the board for some 6 years of a nonprofit organization called Reed Global, which builds libraries/community centers in villages in Nepal, India, and Bhutan. They've been doing this for over 20 years now. Every single one of these centers that has been built since 1992 is still in operation. And this is in the most scattered villages throughout Nepal. And if you have any knowledge about recent Nepali history, you know that there was a Maoist civil war that dragged on for decades and that divided the people of the entire country, still does up to a point, and that caused all manner of violence. And yet every single one of these Reed centers remains in operation. Why? Because the people in the village, first of all, asked for it, put up some of the money for it, built it themselves, designed the businesses to sustain it, staffed the businesses, and hired the librarians for the library. They're bought in. And I believe that a community that is benefiting from a business like one of those I've described for you is going to be very unlikely to want to stop the activity and deny people safe drinking water or solar energy or whatever it is that they're receiving from the company over political differences. I could be naive. I've been accused of that over the years. But I saw this for years and years with Reed and still do. And I believe that this is a solution that can transcend politics.
This sounds like a really great set of ideas. I'm wondering how you see the contribution of the business solution to poverty stacking up against technological and service innovations that were not initially designed to serve the poor, but then got adapted mm-hmm. to the needs of the poor through people's own ingenuity. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering what sort of dent you hope that this kind of intentional design for the poor will make in comparison to, say, cell phones or prepaid phone cards, and that's the example that comes to mind.
Let a thousand flowers bloom. I do think you're talking mostly about cell phones and telephony related innovations. Yes, there have been some absolutely fabulous breakthroughs. Particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, increasingly now in South Asia as well, but in East Africa in particular, Kenya, where something like 80% of the people actually now bank, using texting on their mobile phones. So I don't see this as in any way competitive. I see these as complementary efforts. At Spring Health, for example, we would love to have a text banking system set up that we can use for payments and for collections. It would be vastly more efficient than having to send people to people's homes. Right now, there isn't an affordable solution for that. M-Pesa, the company in Kenya that has pioneered this area, is in India, but has not made the kind of headway that we would like to see.
Oh, hi, I'm Aveling. So I have a question. Even with these low-cost designs, will these products still be affordable for, like, the poorest of the poor?
Well, the poorest of the poor, people who are truly destitute and have no money, no food, no shelter, are not going to be part of a market economy, admittedly. But the reality is that of those 2.7 billion people I'm talking about, the overwhelming majority are people who do have some means. It may be as little as 50 cents a day in income, and that's averaged over the course of a year. That's not at any given day. But that's enough if you have the financing mechanisms in place to help people acquire new products and services affordably. It's enough to make it possible to do business with them.
How would you characterize some of the investors in these businesses? Are most of them from those countries? Are they people just learning, you know, looking for an equivalent investment opportunity to make money? I mean, how would you identify these people? Do they self-identify and so forth?
Yes, they do. I'd say that about half of them are located in India or else in other countries where the businesses will operate. And about half of them are from Europe and North America. I would say that at this point, in the early stages of all these companies, they all self-identify as impact investors. In other words, they are people who are looking for some social payoff as well as some sort of return on their investment. Some of them are funds, Calvert funds, for example. The Calvert Foundation has invested in at least one of the companies, and there are others. There are other funds that are India-based that are comparable, where people have put their money in hopes of helping to develop the country. And they're hoping also that they will get a return on their investment as well.
I'd like to add on to his question. Finca has proven that women can utilize the money for what it was meant for most wisely because they care about their families and their children and all. So is this targeted towards women at all, and do you work with other NGOs like Kiva and Finca and others that are doing lending to people within a framework of targeting those companies or anything?
Well, we're not currently working with any of those organizations, although I'm familiar with all of them. In the years when IDE was marketing the treadle pump, they did work closely with microcredit programs as a way to finance, for farmers to finance the purchase of the pumps. And I would expect that would be the case in many areas as well. Whether they would, there's no intention currently, given the products that are now under development, products and services, to favor women over men. Certainly, I understand exactly what you're saying. The men go off and get drunk, and the women spend it on their families. And that is that stereotype, though it may be, it is all too disturbingly common. So, what we What we find, though, what Paul found through IDE was that as the family's income rose, their expectations rose, their demands rose. It was no longer just the farmer, the man, if it was in fact a man, who could call all the shots, because the children needed shoes to go to school, and the women needed some help for transportation to go to market to sell their artisanal goods. So far I think that the evidence suggests that this approach does help people improve their quality of life, and does not contribute more toward wasting money on religious festivals and on alcohol.
Well, you had me at treadle pump, because I worked in Mali with Blacksmiths Association in actually manufacturing and selling treadle pumps. So you totally had me there. But my question, it was very interesting, because your focus is really on creating more rural wealth, rural-based businesses.
Yes.
And how do you try to steer investors or business people towards that? Because as you're looking at trying to, frankly, it's a numbers game to a certain extent. When you look at the number of urban poor or peri-urban poor, when
yes.
you look at the concentration densities there
yes.
and the levers that you would use to be able to have an impact there, how do you, it sounds like you're explicitly trying to focus people towards rural, and
yes.
how do you have those conversations with, frankly, if you invest a dollar in trying to find an urban solution that could potentially impact X number of people and sell X amount of products and profit versus the rural solution. So just interesting in that conversation between those two elements.
Well, let's take safe drinking water, for example. In the towns and cities, the $6,000 solution, reverse osmosis, is cost effective. And so Spring Health could hardly compete successfully with companies that offer safe drinking water developed by that method. Frankly, from a business perspective, it makes more sense to go where there's no competition. That's a flip answer, though it is definitely part of the answer. But to go a little bit further on that point, because I think it's an important one, I believe that that humanity will not survive if all of us are living in cities. I believe we must develop the rural areas. We must lift poor people into something approaching livable circumstances so that they're not all flocking to the cities. The size of these megalopolises in Africa and Asia, even places like Mexico City now, are just totally out of control. What is Lagos's population now? 20 million or something? 17, 20, 22 million? It's not as though they're moving into New York and building atop each other. It's that they're spread out, taking up lots of arable farmland for shanty towns. And it's a lose-lose situation. So I do believe that there is an urgent need to focus on rural development.
You got me at the treadle pump also. I saw one in Honduras on a coffee plantation, and it was bought by a woman who went to some conference, I think, where these things were sold. So
uh-huh.
they had the only one, I think, in the country. But I was curious, since your background was basically Ecuador, I think.
Yes.
But it seems like your partner's mainly focused on Asia and Africa. So I'm wondering, mm-hmm. do you have comparable programs in Latin America, any part of Latin America?
Not currently, although Paul has worked in Central America, Nicaragua particularly, and I think in Guatemala as well. But most of the focus is on the places where the poor people are, and overwhelmingly they're in India and sub-Saharan Africa. The numbers are there. I mean, the population of India now is 1.25 billion people, and two-thirds of those people live on $2 a day or less. 800 million people. That's more people than there are in the Western Hemisphere, as a matter of fact.
I'm curious about the picking of the storekeeper, because it seems like that most of the profit actually goes to that person. I'm wondering if that person's chosen for kind of community development traits, and or that if they're not, if there's a lot of jealousy at the end about that person.
I can't say. I haven't looked at that, but I'm sure there is some jealousy. But it's not most of the profits. Because the storekeeper has to spread some of that profit around, hiring people to help. As these businesses take off, and they do, they have to hire more and more people for delivery, and the storekeepers to begin with tend to be more affluent than the rest of the people in the community, by and large, because they have that extra source of income. So yes, I'm sure that there will be some social tensions that develop. But we're not talking about people who are millionaires. We're talking about people who are just barely living above subsistence. And I, for one, don't regret helping them double or triple or even quadruple their income to be able to support their families more effectively.
Hi, I was wondering about the impact of overpopulation in these underdeveloped countries, and is there a way to market, for instance, the idea of birth control and education of women to kind of lower the rate of population growth in these underdeveloped countries?
Oh, there definitely are ways to do that. I mean, whether it can be done through a profit-making business is unclear. But I would suggest that you look at the experience of Thailand and of a remarkable man who is known there as Dr. Condom. Dr. Condom was a very successful businessman. I think he had inherited some money, and he built up an industrial empire of sorts. When in the mid-70s, he decided that he wanted to do something more for the country. Thailand at that point had an absolutely astronomical birth rate, something like an average of seven children per woman. It was just way off the charts. And so he decided that he would use his marketing skills from his businesses to sell contraception. And among other things, he did soap operas and comic books and used other means, which he paid for through a nonprofit organization he'd set up. And he eventually then began to support the whole operation by starting a chain of restaurants called Cabbages and Condoms. And if you go to Bangkok, look for the restaurant called Cabbages and Condoms, and you will just crack up. It is, they have condoms of all sizes, shapes, and colors, and framed in glass cases on the walls and spread out on every table underneath glass. And with your coffee, you get a condom instead of a mint. And Dr. Condom has been world-renowned for the success that he's had in lowering that birth rate from something like 7 to something like 2. And it took 30, 40 years to do that, but that's what it takes.
My question is somewhat related, although I'm sure the humor won't be equal to this last, but you began your talk mentioning comparing the former rate of poverty, that now there are more poor than the total world population. But I wonder about the proportion. Is the proportion of poor people roughly the same? That almost implies that the lives are maybe almost not worth being created, or anyway, it's. I wonder what your answer to that.
Well, it's a decent question. I don't have a glib answer for that one. I do think that no matter how much you monkey with the percentages, and that's what the UN and the World Bank do. They say we've reduced the percentage of people who live on a dollar and a quarter a day from X percent to Y percent over the last 10 years. Well, supposedly, yes. And so no matter how much you indulge in that kind of arithmetic, you still find that you have a huge number of people who are just living barely above the level of destitution. Now, how you measure that, I mean, is it a dollar a day, a dollar and a quarter a day, $2.50 a day? There's a lot of debate about that. The most generally accepted measure of global poverty is $2 a day now. That's my understanding of my reading of it. I just don't think that people living on $2 a day are enjoying the opportunities that life should afford them.
On that note, we don't have enough time for more questions, but he will be available to answer your questions after this program. I want to thank you very much,
Thank you, Karen.
A wonderful presentation. Very interesting. And his book, The Business Solution to Poverty, it will be on sale outside, where he will also be able to sign the books for you. So now, this tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.